I would invite you to open up your Bibles to the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 2. We'll be looking at that passage in just a moment. The Lord's blessed us with a beautiful day. We do have several who are traveling today of our number, but we do also have some visiting with us, and we're glad that you're here worshiping God with us this day. About 6 weeks ago or so, I preached a lesson about the challenges and blessings of marriage. We looked at some biblical passages that talked about that and talked about some responses that I got out of a questionnaire that I sent to some of the married folks about their challenges and blessings in marriage. And we noted at that time that there was a particular subject that we needed to come back to, and that was the responsibility that's given to the husband. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 23, it says that the husband is the head of the wife, just as also Christ is head of the church. What does that mean, to be head of the wife? You know, this is particularly important for us to understand in our culture today, which fights against that concept so strongly. We have had, starting in the last century in particular, this women's movement, the women's liberation movement, which has done some good, but has done a great deal to destroy the concept of biblical marriage, of this idea, which seems so offensive to some, that the man is to be the head of the wife, and that the wife is to be in submission to the husband. Coupled with that, the disintegration of the marriage institution itself. So many people are not following the principles of God, fulfilling the responsibilities that God has given husband and wife, and in its wake leaving destroyed homes and broken lives. Today, a lot of people are not even getting married. 1 year, they're living with this one, and next year, they're living with someone else. We have a whole group of young people who are growing up without really any concept of what it means for a man to be a leader, of what it means for a man, a husband, to be head of the wife, and for the wife to be in submission to the husband. They don't know the teaching, and they have very few, if any, role models that they can follow. So when we read passages such as Ephesians chapter 5, it gives us clarity. God is showing what it is to have an ideal marriage, for the husband to be head of the wife and the wife to be in submission to the husband. But again, what does it mean? That truth has not changed, nor will it ever change. What I would like for us to do this morning, and maybe in some lessons in the near future, is to examine some biblical examples, some people in the Bible who have demonstrated what it means to be head of the family. For some reason, the screen is not working here. My clicker is not working, or something's not working here, because we should have a nice picture of Moses showing up here. Moses is the man I'd like to focus in on. There we are. Moses as the head of the home. And so what I like to do is kind of look at some of these biblical characters and the example that they have, the role that they fulfilled, and how they can be role models for us today. So let's examine this man Moses. In chapter 2, a few weeks ago, we talked about the birth of Moses, the raising of Moses, and we introduced this idea that Moses was born, he was supposed to be killed, but was rescued. He became the son of Pharaoh's daughter. In verse 10, it says of Exodus chapter 2, the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. Moses was one of these children that really didn't have the advantage of having a strong, stable, consistent home life. He, at his childhood, apparently had a good home life with Amram and Jochebed, and they sought to instill faith within him, but he was removed from that home and put into this blended family, this family with Pharaoh's daughter. It says nothing about a father, It says nothing about the way that he is raised, but he would have been raised with the idolatry and the immorality of the Egyptians. It would have been difficult for Moses. He could have very easily made a lot of excuses about his upbringing. He could have turned out very bitter about what he had to endure and never fulfilled the role that God wanted him to fulfill as a leader, as really one of the greatest leaders this world has seen. But he did make excuses. He became the leader that God wanted him to be, not only in the nation of Israel, but also in his family. So let's make a few observations. First observation, and you'll just have to work it back there. I don't think my thing's working here. First observation is that headship is given, not taken. The next verse here, let's read Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Moses is about 40 years old at this time, and it seems as though he's trying to take the role of leadership. As a matter of fact, let's jump over to the New Testament. Keep your finger here in Exodus because we'll come right back. But jump over to the book of Acts, chapter 7. We're really given more insight into what's taking place in the motivation of Moses. And in chapter 7 of Acts, in verse 22, Stephen is speaking about history, and he says of Moses that Moses was learned in all of the wisdom of the Egyptian and was mighty in words and deeds. But when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. Now notice this next phrase. It gives us some additional insight unto the motivation of Moses. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. The next day he appeared to two of them. They were fighting, and it shows that they rejected him really as their leader. So when Moses is 40 years old, he seems to, either by God's direction or by his own desire, to want to become the leader of the Israelites, to deliver them out of captivity, but they didn't give it to him. They weren't ready for him to be leader at this time. They rejected him as leader. And so Moses is going to have to go away. Let's go back to the book of Exodus, chapter 2. And we'll pick up the reading here in verse 16, because he is leaving Egypt at this time. And it says, "Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled their troughs with water to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And they came to Reuel their father," or Jethro their father. "And he said, 'How is it that you have come so soon today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian delivered us,'" that was Moses, "'and from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock.' And he said to his daughters, 'And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread.' Then Moses was content to live with the man. And he gave Zipporah his wife to Moses, and she bore him a son. And he called his name Gershom, for he said, 'I have been a stranger in a foreign land.'" Moses goes to Midian, and we're not sure of the timing. Bible doesn't tell us how long it is that he stayed there and was the shepherd of the flock of Jethro before he gives him Zipporah. But it says that he does give him Zipporah to be his wife. Now, notice that Moses does not take her to be his wife. And when he becomes his wife, when she becomes his wife, it's that he is going to really be able to take from her the headship in the home. This was a gift that was given to him. It was a gift that was given to him from Jethro, who was the head of his house, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to be his wife. And really, in a practical way, it would have to be Zipporah. Because no matter what Dad says, Zipporah's got her own will and has her own life. She is going to have to give the leadership of the family, the leadership of her, unto this man, Moses. Well, we continue the reading here in chapter 3, that about 40 years later, Moses is about 80 years old at the time, and we find that God comes and speaks to him in chapter 3 in verse 10. It says, "Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So now God is going to send them back at age 80 and is going to allow him to be, or cause him to be, the deliverer, the leader of the children of Israel. He is giving him this role. He is going to, Moses is going to decide to go, and in chapter 4 and verse 20, we find that Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand. So he goes back to Egypt, and he gathers together the elders of the land. We jump down in the same context here to chapter 4 and in verse 29. "Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all of the elders of the children of Israel, and Aaron spoke all of the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, and that he looked on their affliction, then they bowed their head and worshiped." It was really at this time that Israel gave the leadership to Moses. It's at this time that they're willing to follow Moses. A man cannot be a leader if he is not given that leadership. A man cannot become a leader if no one is willing to follow. And Moses is an illustration, I believe, of a man, not just in his marriage, but in his life, who was not a man who took the leadership role, who said, "I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to make people follow what I want to do. I am the one who's in charge of my destiny, and I am going to follow this path, and you must get in line." That's not the type of leadership that Moses had. It was not the type of leadership that was successful in his life. The type of headship that he had was a headship that was given to him, so that he became the head, so that he became the leader, because he was following God's ways. You know, sometimes young husbands, sometimes older husbands, seek to impose their headship on their wife, seek to take the reins of authority, seek to say, "It is going to be my way in this home." You know, in the Latin community, Latin culture, specifically in Mexican culture, there is this thing called machismo. Machismo is this exaggerated masculinity. If you go into some Mexican homes, you find that the man is definitely the dominant role. The man is the one who says, "Get me my slippers. Where is my dinner? Bring them to me now." In many Mexican homes, there are men who physically abuse and verbally abuse their wives to make sure that they recognize that they're the man. It makes them feel like a man. In many homes, the man is having multiple sex partners because he's the man and because he can. This is not the type of headship that God is talking about. Unfortunately, in our culture, maybe because of some of those same machismo attitudes among some of a previous generation, has gone to the opposite extreme. And the women have said, "No more of this. We don't like this overbearing maleness. And so what we're going to do is we're going to become the overbearing femaleness." Rather than going to the truth, which is leadership based upon love and respect, they want to be the leaders. They want to take the reins. They say, "I am woman, hear me roar. I am not going to follow any man. I am going to have my own way. I am going to have my own education. I'm going to have my own career. I'm going to do my own thing. And if a man wants to be around, that's his problem. He's going to have to follow me. Well, the truth and the harmony and the way that it really works, if it's going to work properly, is what God wants us to have. Notice in the book of Ephesians, in the fifth chapter, Paul talks about this harmony that's going to take place in the home by both the husband and the wife fulfilling their responsibilities properly and in accordance with love. He says in chapter 5, we'll start in verse 22, where it says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church." And he continues with this discussion of what it means for the husband to love the wives. But notice again in verse 22, the first thing Paul says is, "Wives, submit to your own husbands, for the husband is the head of the wife." He doesn't say it the other way around, does he? He doesn't say, "Husbands, submit your wives, for you are the head of your wife." No, it's voluntary submission that the wife gives. It is a gift that she presents unto her husband. It is not something that is to be taken by the man. Jesus did not take leadership, did he? Jesus came to this earth. Jesus did the will of the Father. Jesus demonstrated himself to be a loving and a true and a sacrificial Savior. And then he says, "Come, follow me." No one has Christ as their Savior. No one has Christ as their head who does not voluntarily submit. Jesus does not force that. Jesus does not take that from us. And we as husbands are not to take that from our wives. Wives, have you given that gift? Husbands, do you recognize that gift as the divine, precious gift that it is, and cherish that gift, and rise to the responsibility of that gift? When we become a husband, we view our responsibility as head of wife as a divine gift. We follow divine wisdom. We follow in God's ways, and in that way, the relationship has harmony. Headship is given, not taken. I think we can also learn from looking at the life of Moses that headship is not self-centered, but looks to the need of the wife. Let's go back to the book of Exodus and review many of the same passages, but looking at them from this aspect here of the attitude of mind that Moses illustrates. In verse 11 again of chapter 2, it came to pass in those days that when Moses was grown, about 40 years old, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And so he looked this way and that way. When he saw no one, he killed the Egyptians and hid him in the sand. Now, we might rightly say that his compassion for his brethren is misguided. To look this way and that way and kill this Egyptian is not really in accordance to the principles of God. There were other ways for him to solve this situation, but it does illustrate. It illustrates the way that Moses viewed others. He wasn't just thinking about himself. Now, we, a lot of times, politicians, somebody who wants to be the leader, someone who wants to be the one sitting in the chief seat and everyone following him, is someone who takes that responsibility, is someone who is looking out for themselves, is someone who is very selfish in the way that they view things. That's not the type of leadership that Moses had. Though misguided, killing this Egyptian, he was a man who felt very deeply the pain of others. As a matter of fact, let's go to the New Testament, which gives us greater insight into what's going on here in chapter 11. Of the book of Hebrews, we find the Hebrew writer talking about Moses during this time. And he says in verse 24, By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Here is a man who, it says, suffered affliction with the people of God. How did he do that? Did he do that by personally suffering? Well, it may have been growing up in the home of an Egyptian, he being of a different blood, he being of a slave's blood. Maybe as he grew up, there were some jeers thrown at him. Maybe they made fun of him because, Moses, you are not of the elite Egyptian blood. You are of this slave blood. You are of the Hebrews. Maybe he was insulted. Maybe he was not properly received in his home. But it seems, the emphasis is, that he suffered affliction with the people of God because he empathized with them. As the text in Exodus tells us, he goes out and he sees what's happening among his people, among his brethren, and he feels for them. He wants to defend them. He wants to do something about it. The next day, after he kills this Egyptian, he goes out and he sees his brethren quarreling, and he talks to the one who was in the wrong, and he says, "Why are you doing this? Are you not brethren?" Well, they did not accept his compassion, did not accept his leadership. But nonetheless, it does illustrate the leadership quality that Moses had. Let's go back to Exodus and see another illustration of this capacity that he had, this characteristic that he had of looking to others. When he goes to Midian, again in verse 16, "Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs of water to their father's flock, to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood and helped them and watered their flock." Now, why did he do this? He's this foreigner. He's this Egyptian. He's running from his homeland. He's running from the home of Pharaoh's daughter. He's running from his people, the Hebrews, because they've rejected him. Pharaoh is out to kill him. He's sitting down here at this well, and he could have very easily said, "Hey, listen, I'm the one that needs some water here. I'm the one that needs some pity here. I'm the one that's running from Pharaoh. Somebody help me out here. Who are these girls that are coming here with these sheep? Let them take care of themselves. Apparently, this happens all the time. I'm not going to solve this problem, and so let them deal with it." That could have been his attitude, but that's not Moses. Moses was a man who had compassion on others. Moses didn't just think about himself. He thought about the plight of these girls, and so he helped them out. And when he helped them out, it was recognized by Raoul, this Jethro. Jethro was a priest of God. Jethro is later, in chapter 18, going to offer praise and sacrifice to God because of the deliverance of the children of Israel. He is a man of God. He is a man of faith. And he recognizes in Moses this quality, a very important quality for him to have of caring for others. We go to the book of Exodus in chapter 4 and verse 20. And notice that again, in the detail that's given to us in the context here, it says, "Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt." What did Moses ride on? It doesn't say anything about what he rode on, but it does say what he did for his family. Yes, he took charge. Yes, it is him who decides where they're going to go, and he sets them on this donkey, and he takes them to Egypt, but he is caring for his family. And interesting, jump a little bit ahead in the context here of chapter 18. This is after they go to Egypt, after the plagues, after they journey through the wilderness, about when they are going to receive the law. It says in chapter 18 and verse 1, "And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that God had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons, of whom was named Gershom, and he goes on. When did Moses send him back? Why would Moses send him back to the father-in-law? Well, it seems that he was thinking about their best interest. Here he was in Egypt. He was going through this series of plagues. It was a very dangerous time for him. He could have been harmed. He could have been killed. So he is thinking of the safety of his family. He sends them back to his father-in-law, Jethro. And it wasn't until after that had solution that he was able to bring his family back and they were able to travel together again. This quality is essential for headship. And that is that we cannot be concerned with our own needs, but we are concerned with the needs of others. Notice in the New Testament, Peter points this out when he is talking about the husband's responsibility in marriage. 1 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 7. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. When God is commanding, this is not a suggestion given to the husbands. This is a command that's given to the husband. When he is commanding the responsibility of the husband, does God tell the husband, "Husband, you make sure that you understand your needs. You make sure that your needs are met. You make sure that you are treated with honor and respect. You make sure that everyone around you knows how precious you are." That's not the command that's given here, because that usually comes pretty naturally. People usually fend for themselves and make sure that their needs are understood. The commandment that's given here, the commandment of God, is for you husbands to understand your wives and to honor your wives. Put them on a pedestal. Treat them as they should be treated. Don't think about yourself all of the time, about your needs and about your wants. But you think about the needs and the wants of your spouse. Again, in our culture, we've had such a conflict with the women's liberation movement raising up and saying, "No, it's me that needs to be noticed. It's my needs that need to be reckoned with. I need, as a woman, need to be respected." There's been a battle, there's been a fight, because you have the man saying, "No, it's me, and you have the woman saying, "No, it's me. The solution that God gives is quit thinking about yourself. Husband, it's your command to think about the wife. You make sure that her needs are understood. You make sure that she is respected. That's what love does. That's what is going to bring about harmony." And in the book of Ephesians, in the 5th chapter, and in verse 28, the Apostle Paul makes the very same point when he says in verse 28, Ephesians 5, "So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church." Man nourishes and cherishes himself, but that's not the command given to us. The command given to us is that you make sure that you have that attitude towards your wife. She is literally taking from your body. Eve was made from the body of Adam. Treat her as your own body. And two words in particular in verse 29, it says, "but nourish." The word "nourish" means to feed. It means to provide. It is the husband's responsibility to provide in the family. Now, understand that message is completely distorted and all mixed up in our culture, but not in the Bible. In the Bible, headship means that the husband is to be the provider in the family. And yes, the wife can help in that matter, but the man has the main responsibility to be the provider, because he is thinking about the needs of others, not of himself. The second word is used here, cherishes it. He is to be the protector in the home. The woman has many strengths, strong in many areas, but it is the husband's responsibility to be the protector in the home. That's what leadership means. That's what thinking about others is all about. That's what Moses illustrates and what we should follow. But one third observation that we can make from Moses is that headship is not infallibility, but seeks answers from wife and from others. Let's go back to the book of Exodus. Look at chapter 3 again, where God sends Moses back to Pharaoh. "Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." There's the responsibility that is given by God to Pharaoh, to Moses to go back to Pharaoh. But in chapter 4, notice that it says in verse 18, "So Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, 'Please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see whether they are still alive.' And Jethro said to Moses, 'Go in peace.'" I thought he was the head of his house, Moses. He was to be the leader of his house. He had a mission by God to do what he was supposed to do. Why did he go and ask Jethro? Because that's what a good leader does. A good leader is coordinating with. A good leader is talking with. He had a responsibility in Jethro's house. He was the shepherd. He was taking care of the sheep. For him to leave, he was going to have to get things in order. And so he goes and speaks to Jethro about that in verse 20. "Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt." Now, the text does not tell us all of the details, but I would, particularly in harmony with the first two points, would conclude that Moses went and talked to Zipporah about this mission. Yes, it was a mission specifically given to him from God, but a good leader is going to get the input from the one who has given him that leadership, who has submitted herself to him. I believe he went and he talked to Zipporah and explained the situation, explained the responsibility, explained the blessings of the Lord, and from their discussion was able to come to this consensus. Moses does not go in and say, "We are living, I have decided, this is the way that we're going to go, and I am head, so you follow me." A good head is one who seeks input from others. Well, they go to Egypt, and he goes through the series of plagues, and he leads the people out. Let's go to chapter 18 again. And notice another instance that illustrates this quality of Moses. Pick up the reading here in verse 13. It says that, "So it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood before Moses from morning till evening. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, 'What is this thing that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone and all of the people stand before you from morning till evening?' Moses said to his father-in-law, 'Because the people come to inquire of the Lord. When they have a difficulty, they come to me and I judge between one another, and I make known the statutes of the Lord and his laws.' So Moses' father-in-law said to him, 'The thing that you do is not good. I've got a suggestion for you. There's a better way for you to do this. Your intentions are good, trying to help these people out, but I have there are some things that you could do to facilitate this. Number one, teach the people themselves. Tell them what the law of God is so that they can figure it out for themselves. And number two, get some helpers to come with you." And notice in verse 24 what happens. "So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he said." Now, what does that mean about the leadership of Moses? Does that mean that Moses was a bad leader? No, that's the mark of a good leader. Someone who recognizes that just because he is in the role of leader does not mean that he's infallible, does not mean that he has all the answers. He knows everything. He is someone who recognizes that he needs to get input from others, input that will help him make the proper decisions. Another interesting incident in his life, in Numbers, they are almost ready to enter into the land, or at least to send the spies into the land. And Miriam and Aaron come to Moses. Now, Miriam and Aaron are his sister and his brother. Should be very close to him, but they're going to criticize him in chapter 12 and verse 1. "Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has not he spoken through us also? And the Lord heard it. Now, it seems their main problem was jealousy. Moses is the leader, and they are playing second fiddle, and they want a higher position, a greater role. And so they criticize Moses, which is odd that they would criticize the wife that he would have. Maybe they're saying that she has too much input. I don't know exactly the reason why they bring up the wife. But she is not a Hebrew, not a Jew. And so they bring this up against his leadership. In verse 4 it says, suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out, and God is going to answer. God is going to say, Moses is the man that I chose. And in fact, he's going to give Miriam leprosy to demonstrate that he has not chosen her. So God settles it for him. But right in the midst of that, it said something very significant about the character of Moses. Verse 3, he is being criticized for his leadership, and what does he do? Does he stand up and say, now listen, I'm the leader, I'm the man, I'm the one, I don't need anybody telling me anything because that's who I am, I'm the leader, so I know everything? That's not what the text tells us about Moses. It says, now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. He's a humble man. He's a meek man. He's moldable. He's teachable. He recognizes that he needs the input from other wise individuals to be able to lead properly. But Moses is one of the greatest leaders in the history of the world. Is it possible to be a good leader and to be humble? Is it possible to be a good leader and not know all of the answers? I think that's exactly what Moses is illustrating for us here. His humility, in fact, is the basis for his leadership, strong leadership, in getting done what needs to be done. Notice in the New Testament, in the book of Ephesians, in the 5th chapter, Paul points to the need of the man to be the leader in the home when he says in chapter 5 and verse 31, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Notice that it does not say, for this reason a woman shall leave her father and mother and be joined to her husband. She's not the leader in making this home. He is the leader. The man is the leader in making the home. He is the one that needs to make sure that it gets done. But in doing that, he is a man who seeks the advice and the counsel and discussion with the wife and other ones that so that everything can be brought into harmony. I say this for those who are husbands who are so timid and so afraid of their wives that they never really become the leader. And maybe they feel inferior. Maybe they feel insecure. I don't know all of the answers. I don't have all of the direction I need to go. I need help. That doesn't mean that you cannot be a good leader. In fact, that's what you need in order to be a good leader. And I also say this to those husbands who begin or in the process of their marriage, who are very arrogant and opinionated and who say, my way the only way. I don't need to hear what you have to say, dear, because I know everything before you say it, because I am head of the wife. I'm head of this house. Headship does not mean infallibility. It means that we listen to the wise counsel of all, but when it comes down to it, we're the ones that have the responsibility to make sure that it gets done. We may not know all there is to know about finances, but it's our job to make sure our house's finances are in order. We may not know all there is to know about educating a child, but it's our job to make sure that education of that child is done. We may not know all there is to know about how it is for the husband and wife to work together in harmony and grow in their relationship, but it's our responsibility to make sure that we are growing as husband and wife. We may not know all there is to know about what God wants us to do in this life and what His purpose is, but it's our job to make sure that the will of God gets done in our lives. That we are the leaders. We take the responsibility. And at taking that responsibility, we get wise counsel from all sources. But then we get it done. Moses was a man, I think, that illustrates well for us what true leadership was, not only in the nation of Israel, but also in his home. Headship is given, not taken. When Moses tried to take it, he was rejected. But when he was given it by the people, by his wives, by God, and when he saw that gift as precious, he became a great leader. Moses was a man that was not self-centered. He was constantly looking for the betterment of others. He was providing. He was protecting. And it made him a great leader. Moses was a man who did not see himself as infallible. He sought answers from his wife and for others. And then he got the job done. Because he was the head, he was the leader. Yes, we need in our society today, yes, we need in our homes today, men who understand their role as leaders and who fulfill that responsibility. If you're not a Christian in the audience, Jesus is also the head of the church and is the greatest leader that this world has ever seen. But he is not our leader until we give it to him. Leadership of our lives. If you're not a Christian, we would encourage you to give it to Him this morning. Give it to Him by believing, by repenting, by confessing, by being baptized, by giving your life unto the Lord this morning. If you are a Christian, for some reason have taken that back, taken the reins back and have messed up your life, we would encourage you to come forward this morning and give the reins back to the Lord. Won't you come while we stand and sing?